Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Jim Moyer, pioneering publishing entrepreneur, publisher, ACMQ. Jim, you have this amazing background, and I know you have a really heavy schedule, so thank you for coming in today.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure, Stephen, and it's really a special treat to have been invited to talk with you.
Now, Jim, in your early years prior to college, what were you really passionate about?
Well, I grew up in Illinois, where my family's business was printing, and I was fortunate to have had the opportunity to work in a small print shop after school and on weekends, and I just loved it. During that time, I learned how to do a lot of printing things, from setting up old-style letter presses to cleaning them to setting type, handling the various types of paper we stocked, and so on. The printing shop dealt with a wide range of printing projects, ranging from large jobs like record jackets that we printed for Capitol Records when vinyl records were still in existence, to small jobs like wedding invitations and personal stationery. I just loved it and was passionate about every detail of it, and it turned out to be terrific background for the career choice of publishing that I made many years later.
What prompted you to get into your master's at Chapel Hill?
I had both a cultural and an intellectual interest in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I did not have much familiarity with the southern United States at that time, but felt that it was probably a place with great charm and a place that I would like, and I was right. Intellectually, I had a strong interest in linguistics from my undergraduate work. And the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill at that time had one of the strongest and best linguistics department in the United States.
Now, Jim, can you further profile your history prior to your current role and a defining and usable lesson you wish to share from each of your major assignments in your life or roles in your history?
Well, I'll try. My history in publishing has been seasoned with a great deal of good fortune. My first job in New York City was with Charles Scribner's Sons, a highly respected publishing company that many people may recognize as the publisher of F. Scott Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Thomas Wolfe, and so on. But Scribner's is also a company that had an exceptional reference publishing division. I was fortunate to work with some of the top scientists and science historians in the world on some amazing projects, like a 16-volume dictionary of scientific biography, a series called The Album of Science, and so on, at Scribner's reference. Then I moved from Scribner's to a company called W.H. Freeman and Scientific American. They were a pair then, where I first worked on textbooks and then on some of the Scientific American magazine projects. And at Scribner's and Scientific American, I'd say I learned how to help really smart people, mostly scientists, effectively convey their ideas to others, to readers, who were in most cases not at the same experience or intelligence level as the writers. After Scientific American, a colleague who had been president of Scientific American Publishing and I decided that we would start our own business, which ended up being funded through venture capital. Our company, which was called Cogito Learning Media, focused on creating electronic supplemental products for college-level science courses students generally have difficulty with. We published in statistics, economics, genetics, molecular cell biology, advanced math courses, things like that. We wrote a business plan. We raised venture capital based on that plan. Anyway, suffice it to say that working in these different companies, all of which had an emphasis on quality and content, but had very different ways of developing and delivering that content, gave me a deep and broad understanding of both the joys and the challenges that the publishing industry can offer. And certainly starting a business from scratch forced me to grapple with the economic side of the publishing process and to understand it better as a business and an industry.
Now, Jim, you've got this long history of success in publishing, and you must have come across some interesting challenges. Can you share some of those main challenges, and can you give some specific examples?
Sure. Quality products are essential to any publisher's success, and that certainly holds for scientific and technical publishing, just as with a novel or an art book or whatever. In science, it's usually important to get new information published quickly or before someone else. So time versus quality is always a challenge that looms. A second challenge is economics and quality. A quality publishing process is expensive. And so a publisher needs to determine how much fact-checking, how much peer review, and so on each product will require. And unfortunately, those processes can be costly. And while there's a lot of pressure to, say, keep the cost of textbooks low or allow free and open access to content on a website, it's very hard to do when so much expense is involved in producing it. A third and related challenge is the changing view of the need for trained and experienced publishing professionals. Some people believe that if you just self-publish, you can control that expense that I just mentioned, and that the end result might be just as good. In our current culture of, you know, instant messaging, blogging, crowdsourcing, and so on, it's hard sometimes to convince a prospective author of the value of taking time to work with an editor on the development of an article or a book or a video. To some authors, that seems to just add time to the process. They're not sure how much added quality will result from that extra time. Same holds for designers and artists. Some people prefer to handle that on their own now. Some authors just don't see added value. A fourth challenge is more recent. It used to be that print was the way to deliver most of the content we're talking about, and now it's important for a publisher to take advantage of all media formats so as to deliver content in the way that your audience is set up or prefers to receive it. So that can be print, but it might also be video, audio, or any combination of media. The choices can be daunting, so now an editor needs to be technically proficient as well as a good wordsmith. And I guess the final challenge would be that those of us who've been involved in the industry for a long time, to hang on to the best standards of excellence from a very long publishing tradition, but at the same time, not be resistant to and take advantage of the new models that are available now.
Jim, I'm fascinated by this sort of entrepreneurial background that you had, and you started a company, you raised money, and so on. So you must have some interesting lessons also to share on that vein. And can you give some examples?
Sure, I can. I think that, at least in my case, if you're going to put all of the effort into starting a new business, you better love it. It should be in an area that you not only know inside out, but that you enjoy immensely, because there's just no question that it's not going to be without challenges. My business, as an example, I mentioned, was in the higher education market, a market that my business partner knew extremely well, and I was deeply involved on the technology side of that. So between the two of us, we had the ground well covered and a lot of experience and a lot of love for the processes involved in that. A second point that kind of flows from the first is the need to be realistic. There's a strong temptation to stray toward a projected maximum success level when talking with potential funders. But it's really much better for everyone and ultimately helps with the pressure on the founders to talk about a mid-level of success when you're raising money. It's also important to be yourself and be a good team player. Just as you shouldn't overpresent the potential of the business, you should not pretend to be something that you really aren't. Venture capitalists don't expect everybody to be Steve Jobs. When deciding which companies to fund, they look at the management team as an entity. So, as I mentioned earlier, my business partner brought certain skills, I brought some, and other members of our team were strong in their areas as well. I think it's important to be able to adjust your vision for success. And pace your growth. I think many venture capital companies and companies that end up receiving their funds will both admit that too rapid growth is often the problem. Incremental, small step-ups in production are often a better approach and easier to accommodate than large jumps. In my company, we began with one product line and only slowly grew that and then introduced others. Lastly, I'd say it's important to know when it's time to leave or at least loosen your personal hold on the business. While this doesn't apply to everyone involved in a startup, it's a fact that sometimes the best thing for the company you start is for you to leave or assume less of a leadership role as the company matures. Visionaries are not always the best people to handle day-to-day, more mundane tasks once the business is up and running. And I think it's a sign of a perceptive founder to know when you've contributed what you can to an endeavor and then move on.
So I would presume then that's kind of prompted you to leave that business at some point because you thought, hey, I've done my bit. I've started the enterprise. It's well on its way, and now it's time to go to some new endeavor?
Exactly. Yeah, I felt it. I had gained enormous experience from just the process of starting up the company. It was exciting. I felt we had done a good job, and we had a successful company moving right along. But I kind of lost interest, as I said, in the day-to-day. I thought there were other people who could do that better than I. And my business partner, as it turns out, is still running the company, and it's doing quite well. But I was content to step aside and let people who still had a higher level of interest than I did keep it going.
You've got this incredible background in publishing and so on, including as an entrepreneur. What kind of attracted you to the ACM? Because I know you've served a long time with the ACM, and I'll have a follow-up question to that. But first of all, what drove you or attracted you to the Association for Computing Machinery, or ACM?
Well, I've worked with the ACM on three separate occasions. First as the publisher of its flagship magazine. A lot of people refer to it as CACM, which is C-A-C-M. And the real name is Communications of the ACM. So I started there working with that project, and I returned twice to help ACM think about how to launch some products and services for computing practitioners. There have always been interesting and unique projects at ACM that seemed like a good fit with my interests and background. A lot of what ACM does requires publishing skills, an interest in science, a desire and a talent for working with scientists and engineers. So far it's been a good match because those are things I like. And as you know, one of the products we developed and launched for practitioners was a magazine, which is now a website, called ACMQ, which offers original and uniquely produced content targeted to the computing practitioner.
Before I get into more questions about ACMQ, how would you define the ACM?
ACM, which is the Association for Computing Machinery, called ACM by most people, is the world's largest educational and scientific computing society. It's by definition, I guess. But in my mind, it's just a wonderful community of people that have some aspect of computing as the common denominator. ACM provides resources to researchers, academics, and as I mentioned, computing practitioners. Resources like a very comprehensive digital library. ACM produces leading edge publications and conferences. Other career resources like webinars and tech packs, just to mention a couple of the products that you've been instrumental in starting with the organization.
Now let's get back to the ACMQ. You are involved with the ACMQ. Can you get into more detail about your involvement and what the ACMQ is?
Yes. ACMQ is now, it was originally a magazine when we started it. It is now an ACM website with content targeted to practicing software engineers. The content is written by engineers, for engineers. The articles focus on practical, technical problems and challenges that loom ahead. They help readers to sharpen their own thinking, and we try to pursue innovative solutions in our articles. We we feel that it's, well, I know that it is. It's different from other publications in that it does not focus on either industry news or solutions in one regard. Rather, Q takes a critical look at current and emerging technologies. Our articles highlight problems that are likely to arise, and we pose questions, often without answers, that software engineers should be thinking about.
So if I'm a software developer and I really want to get sort of cutting-edge information, are you saying that that's kind of the value that I would get from ACMQ?
Absolutely. So often we hear from software engineers that they're working in one particular area and all of a sudden their project shifts and they need to start working on something else. And you have, as a software engineer, you might have a very short period of time to get up to speed on what kinds of challenges and hurdles you're going to face in this new area that perhaps you've not been working in for some time. I think that if you were to go to the ACMQ website and do a search, you would find any number of articles that would help you get up to speed and understand what's going on, what are the challenges, what are the hurdles, what are the questions you should be asking as you enter into this new area.
Now, how will the ACMQ evolve in 2013 and 2014, 15, and so on?
13th next year already, isn't it? Yeah. Well, one thing I haven't mentioned is that Q conceives of its content through a fairly unique publishing process. We have a board of around 15 computing professionals. It's a wonderful mix of some of the smartest young up-and-coming stars, blended with some of the industry's well-known, more seasoned veterans. We meet in person every month with two invited guest experts, and we plan articles and authors to write technical articles on the topics that we discuss in these meetings. So it's a very hands-on activity, and I think it's worthwhile in the sense that so many of our articles are so well received. In 2013, I think one of our challenges is to look at ways of delivering content through channels other than a traditional article format. We know from reader feedback that video, that podcasts, and audio options, for example, would be a welcome addition.
Now, Jim, if I can sort of get into your editorial calendar, what are some notable feature stories, videos, and other featured articles that will appear in ACMQ for 2013?
For 2013, okay. Well, we're starting a new video interview series. Q's print interviews, which were called Conversations, were some of our most popular content. So we thought we would try migrating those into a video format, and we're calling them portraits. So we'll be presenting six or so of these video portraits next year, and we'll see how well they're received. We've done one. The first one is with Robert Watson of Cambridge University, who talks about his current work as a security researcher and open source developer, looking at what we call a hardware-software interface. Anyone listening to this interview, for example, would learn a bit about CPU security, and why applications rather than operating systems are increasingly the focus of security research. Q will also present some case studies and articles next year in areas as diverse as high-frequency trading, real-time web, functional programming, and so on.
You know, this year when I attended some conferences, in fact spoke at some of them as well, I hear these growing trends such as big data, mobile computing, bring your own device, and consumerization of IT, social media, cloud computing, and other disruptive innovations that are appearing. What disruptive changes will this drive in publishing?
Well, certainly computing changes, particularly the devices that you mentioned, which people now use to access and read, view, or hear articles, are major disruptors from the traditional print. But many things work in our favor, certainly. Many Q readers, for example, know or hear about our articles through RSS feeds or referral sites, such as Slashdot, Reddit, or Hacker News, social media, Wikipedia references, drive traffic to us, and give us ideas for articles. So there's a lot to consider now when thinking about how to prepare a piece of content. As I mentioned earlier, deciding on what form that content should take is now a critical aspect of the publishing industry.
Okay, so, you know, there's all of these changes that are occurring around us, and you mentioned some of the changes that will drive in publishing. What's a workable business model then for publishing in, let's say, in 2015?
I wish I had a crystal ball that could provide you and me the answer to that question. In our lifetimes, we've seen paper publishing models bypass in favor of electronic delivery. And now, certainly in the news, we're all hearing, you know, the first issue of Newsweek, for example, that was published in 1933, is going to end with the final issue of 2012. So I do think that there are organizations like ACM that actually are driving change instead of just reacting to it, which is one reason I'm lucky to be there. I can say that I think publishers have to stay light on their feet and adapt with agility to whatever might lie around the corner.
Do you have any sort of thoughts on things like, you know, the social forces that are occurring around the world, the sort of the flattening because of the high use of technology and sort of the availability of published content on the internet and so many different formats? You know, there's predictions of what, something like 4 billion users of the internet within just a few short years. We have 6 billion subscribers to mobile itself. We have all these sort of democratic forces around the world that are kind of shaping the planet. We have all of this technology that is being embedded into everything and lots of intelligence being embedded to everything. And then you talk about the economic forces around the world, and we have all the developing nations striving to become middle-class citizens around the world and having being enabled. How do all of those pieces kind of shape us, do you think, in your mind?
I feel in terms of the publishing industry, I feel that there is a bit of a rub between what an individual does and what an individual does with a group of talented people. Publishing is a talent business. And in the traditional publishing model, editors, designers, and artists all actively participated with the authors in shaping the way that a print article, for example, would read and how it would look. Now, with many of the forces that you're talking about, with blogs, with on-demand publishing, with self-publishing models, it's quite possible for individuals to produce an article, a book, or a video without the application of the talents of the individuals I just mentioned. So with the democratization of our approach to what can be online or what people can get out so easily to the general public, a lot of what is published now may be published without the involvement of a professional publishing group, without peer review, and so on. Where that's going to lead us, I'm not sure.
Well, Jim, it's an interesting world we're coming into, and we're in essence leaving. Do you have any closing comments you want to make, freewheeling just on any topic of your choice?
Nothing in particular, Stephen, other than how much I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about these things. I think that that you and I are both fortunate to be involved in our different ways with the ACM. As I said, I feel that ACM is definitely leading the way for not only computing professionals, but it's associations like ACM and others that are helping publishing get its footing with this new world that you're talking about. It's changed dramatically during my career, and I'm just wide-eyed for the future. I think it's all going to be very interesting.
Well, Jim, again, thank you for coming in today to share your experiences with the audience, and especially with your demanding schedule. We are deeply appreciative that you came in to to share your insights.
Well, thank you, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Jim Moyer, pioneering publishing entrepreneur, publisher, ACMQ.